It's really lovely to be in front of a really big crowd because I'm used to teaching at the New School of Psychotherapy and Counselling on our Masters in Coaching there, and it is just very intimate groups and it's very sort of highly philosophical and academic, and I'm quite looking forward to doing something that's a bit more practitioner focused and in front of such a large audience as well, which is great. So how many of you have any kind of idea about what existential coaching is? Okay, cool. Have any of you done any existential coaching courses? Okay, cool. So we have some people here who know a bit of their stuff. I'm going to try and keep it reasonably simple for those who don't. So, introduction. I like this quote from Woody Allen. I am going to try and give you something more than just no answers, leaving the whole thing blank and assuming that you are going to give me a sort of 100% rating in your minds. But existentialism can get a little bit serious sometimes, so I think it's good to put a bit of humour in it. And on that note, who am I? Is the first question that I wanted to sort of answer for you guys tonight. And there's this nice comic strip here, probably some of you at the back can't see it, but it's basically Kierkegaard sitting in a bar. Somebody comes to try and chat him up and he gets very existential on them and scares them away. That is not what I'm like, thankfully. But there is a bit of a perception of existentialists that they will be a bit like that. So hopefully maybe we can bust some of those myths. Having said that, I do know quite a few existentialists who are a bit like that. So subjectivity. Well, actually, I should tell you who I actually am instead of talking about Kierkegaard. So, as we know, my name is Sacha van Derzen-Smith. I have a Master's in Existential Coaching, which I did alongside Yannick, who is sitting in the audience there. Lovely to see you again. Existentialists quite like this question because there are so many different ways to approach it. So if I were to ask you, who are you, what would come to mind? Who would just think of their name or some sort of fact about themselves? Yeah. Who would think about what they do for a living? Nobody. Wow. That's amazing to me, because most of the time when we ask these kinds of questions, that's the kind of response that you get, or that's the paradigm that we work with. So when you meet someone new, the most common question is, what do you do? As if that somehow defines who we are. So it's quite interesting to try to think about ourselves in lots of different ways, and I'll get a little bit more into that later. So why existential coaching? Well, this is a kind of absurdist response, but really it's something that I kind of fell into. My family were involved in it, Once I kind of looked into it, I got so hooked because I could see that there was such a need for it. And obviously, that's why you're all here in that kind of coaching paradigm, but particularly within the Animas paradigm, which I know is very compatible with an existential approach. A lot of coaching is very doing-focused. It's very goal-orientated, perhaps solution-focused, quite cognitive. Existential coaching is much more about being rather than doing. And of course, that doesn't mean that we completely sacrifice doing and just sit around being all the time, which wouldn't be particularly useful coaching. It does put a slightly different spin on things and a slightly more, I suppose, subjective, individualistic angle to it. So you're thinking less about frameworks that you can apply to people or do to them or techniques that you can use on them. And you kind of co-create a relationship much more. So it's much more about sitting and being with that person, trying as much as you can to get into what their lived experience is, to understand that to a point where not just that they feel heard and understood, but to a point where you can actually properly understand what it is to be them, instead of trying to jump in and do things to them. Why values, images, and narratives? Well, they're just things that I love, frankly. Existential coaching is very much about values, and we'll see that as we go through the presentation. And I just kind of feel that values are at the heart of everything that we do. Whether we realise it or not, most of the time it's tacit knowledge that we don't necessarily think about, or we have some vague idea of the value that's driving something, but perhaps we haven't sort of drilled it down and figured out exactly what's underneath there. Images and narratives, particularly for me, are interesting because if you work with them in a particular way, they're very good at getting people out of a rut or out of a particular kind of belief system that creates a stuckness for them. Again, we'll look at that in more detail as we go on. A very short introduction to existential coaching, because I would be here all night and all day tomorrow and all night tomorrow and all day the day after if we were going to do a proper introduction to existential coaching. But essentially, it emerged from the field of existential psychotherapy, which was based around the notion that we can use ideas from existential philosophers, so Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Sartre, and other such people, to try to better understand what it is to be human, what the sort of common experiences or existential givens are within that, but with an understanding that aside from those givens, we're all unique, everything is totally subjective. So it's that paradox of what are the things, the basic things that we have in common, which is themes like dealing with freedom, responsibility, choice. Well, death anxiety is a favourite, but that tends to come up a bit more in psychotherapy than it does in coaching, although we tend to look at it in coaching in terms more of endings, more generally, and each ending being a sort of a little death and how we respond to that, what our relationship to endings is. And, of course, existential psychotherapy practitioners as well, like Spinelli, Van Deursen, not me, Van Deursen, Emmy Van Deursen, and Viktor Frankl, people like that. So that's a very succinct summary of what existential coaching is. We'll see more of that, I suppose, as we go through and look at some examples of how that actually works in practice and what it really means. So values. I don't know if you can see this quotation. Probably those at the back can't, so I'll read it out. You say I, and you are proud of this word. But greater than this, although you will not believe in it, is your body and its great intelligence, which does not say I, but performs I. That's from Nietzsche. I'm a bit of a Nietzsche fangirl, which sometimes upsets people because he's a little bit problematic in lots of ways. Most of the time I find myself sitting and reading his work and thinking, yeah, yeah, totally agree with that. And then he'll say something absolutely horrendously bigoted, and I'll think, no, Nietzsche, why did you have to ruin it for us all? And then I have this sort of fantasy that because Nietzsche was so into the idea of not adopting the herd mentality and going along with the crowd and sort of being an individualist, that maybe he's just sort of testing my herd mentality and, you know, how willing I am to go along with him. But I don't think it was quite as sophisticated as that, unfortunately. I think he was bigoted. So I quite like this Peanuts cartoon. So Snoopy is thinking, every now and then I feel that my existence is justified. And I quite relate to that. And that's kind of how I see the problem of values, really. Those moments when we do come in close contact with our values and we have a sort of deep understanding of what those values are and how they're driving us, or how we want them to drive us more, how we want to live our values more, those are the moments when I start to feel, certainly, like my existence is somehow more justified. There's a kind of a falling into the trappings of everyday life that gets you away from living those values or recognising those values. And existential philosophy and existential work is very much about getting back to those values all of the time, seeing perhaps some of the hidden effects that they're having on your behaviour, and just being more explicit about them, more aware of them, thinking more about how they drive us and how we want them to drive us. The Four Worlds model is possibly one of the only frameworks, I would say, that existential practitioners are likely to use. So this is the idea. I think this slide went slightly funny and Zoe fixed it for me, so it's not quite exactly how it was supposed to look, but it doesn't really matter. So this is the idea that we live in four kind of different perspectives, four different ways of being. And it's not that any one way of being is superior to the other. They're all important. But we tend to find ourselves veering one way more than the other. So a quick run through of those. Umwelt is the physical world. Does anybody speak German? I know Yannick does. Excellent. So you'll have a leg up on this one. So Umwelt is the physical world. So for example, as I'm standing here talking to you, my awareness of the Umwelt would be, you know, I see people, there are chairs here, the temperature, well, I'm quite warm because I had a bit of a mad dash getting here. All of those sort of physical experiences, those very immediate experiences. And when you think about child development, this is kind of the first stage, really. The first thing that you become aware of as a child is your physical environment, obviously, because of the importance of that in terms of survival. But then next along, you start to develop this awareness of people, other people, society, relationships. You start to think about your family, your friends. You start to develop relationships, think about how you are with other people, how other people are with you. That part of it is called the Mitwelt. It's all about our relationships with others. Then you have the Eigenwelt, which is about the self. So after we go through this phase of developing relationships, thinking about how we are in relation to others, we start to think about how we are in relation to ourselves. And in terms of establishing some kind of sense of personal identity, what it means to be us, which is where that question, who am I, comes in. Although that's kind of related to the Mitwelt as well, because if you ask yourself who you are, it's quite different to somebody else asking who you are. Your response is likely to be very different. And then finally, you have the Überwelt, which is the kind of the world of values, beliefs, philosophy, spirituality. Some people don't like that word, so I'm always careful about saying that first. What values and ideas are driving us? You know, what's important to us? Are we thinking about values of courage? Are we thinking about philosophical ideas about how we're living? I know some people who live very much in that realm, and they find it very, very difficult to get practical. That's always fun when you have a coaching client who's like that, and you're trying to get them to do something practical, and they're sort of off in the world of the Überwelt. The thing that I like to do with students with this, I usually do it before I teach them about it so that they're kind of untainted, is make a list of about 10 or 20 things, and I won't do it now with you, but it's something that you might want to try at some point. Make a list of about 10 or 20 things that you like about yourself or are facts about yourself, things that describe you. And then when you've done that, go through and think about which of these they would fit into. So did you write down something physical, like, I like my hair? Did you write down something about your relationships, like, I'm good with people, or I'm friendly, or I have a good relationship with my family, and I really value that? Did you write about qualities about your identity? So I think that I am brave, or I think that I am funny, or, you know, things like that. Or did you write about these more sort of spiritual, philosophical values? You know, I believe in justice. I'm a very just person. Those kinds of things. You will probably find doing that Possibly not now that I've gone through it with you, because you might be kind of thinking about it when you do it and trying to create a balance. Oh, five of those, five of those, five of those, five of those. But if you do it in a more sort of natural way, not thinking about that, what you'll probably find is that you're tending towards one or two of those worlds more than the other, one of those worlds, ways of being more than the others. And as I say, it's not, the existential belief is not that these are superior, you know, that any one of them is superior. It's more about having an awareness of all of these different ways of being in the world and how they relate to each other and inform each other. So I kind of think of it when I'm working with clients as almost like a ball of yarn with lots of different threads, lots of different colours. And it's about kind of finding the loose thread that you can start to pull to make a sweater out of. So to explain that a little bit more concretely, so you see, I love images. I had a client who I recently wrote up as a case study, who was a young Turkish woman who was very unhappy in her job, actually very unhappy in pretty much every aspect of her life, and really wanted to change her career to work in fashion. She had a real interest in fashion, but she couldn't quite bring herself to kind of make the leap and pursue that path. And when I spoke to her about it, when we sort of tried to tease it out a bit, it became very obvious to me that she was only thinking about her interest in fashion in very limited ways. So, for example, she would, I would talk about some positive things about it, but then start saying things like, oh, but that's really superficial. You know, that's these things aren't really important, are they? It's just, you know, it's just very superficial, very surface. And I kind of realised that perhaps she needed to explore what fashion really meant to her, why it was important to her. It obviously wasn't just a superficial thing for her. She was really passionate about it. And so I used the four worlds, really, to explore what that was. So what were the physical aspects of fashion that were important to her? What was it like for her picking out outfits, or, you know, looking at outfits, thinking about what clothes people might wear? It actually turned out that she came from a family of tailors, and that had been a really, really important part of her childhood. And actually, they taught her all sorts of things about working with clothes, that had given her this real kind of deep appreciation for them that I could not understand at all, you know, and I learned a lot working with her about different materials and things like that, stuff I never thought I would know. And it kind of made me realise that there was a really important piece about identity there for her, and how that family identity was such a big part of her love of clothes, her love of fashion. But also, as we kind of picked it apart and got beyond this idea of it just being superficial, she started to talk about how it was really about the fact that she knew that no matter how bad she felt about herself, if she could pick the right outfit and put it on, she would walk out of the house feeling good. And that was really the crux of it. And she wanted to be able to do that for other people. She wanted to be able to kind of let people in on that secret, on that way of being, and have them benefit from it too. Which was very much in the world of the social, but also in the world of values. And she just hadn't thought about it in terms of that sort of Uberwelt values philosophy. What does this really mean to me? So it's just a kind of an even-handed way of probing someone to make sure that you cover all those bases. And often you'll find a sort of a loose thread somewhere that they haven't quite identified yet, that if you pull on it, you get some motion there. So these are just some sort of summary questions that really describe what you would be looking for at each of those levels. So in the Umwelt, it would be, how am I managing my physical space? How do I feel about my physical space? The Mittvelt would be how am I relating to others and how are they relating to me. The Eigenvelt would be how am I defining myself, what's my sense of identity within this. And the Übervelt would be what are the values that I'm aligned with, what's driving me, what are the ideas. I was challenged recently at a training to give a 1-minute speech on the topic of values, beliefs, and actions, and I was given no more detail other than that, which, as an existentialist, I absolutely loved, and I think I slightly misinterpreted from what they were getting at, but it still worked. And my base point for that was this, again, a Nietzsche quote. You see, Nietzsche fangirl, I can't help it. He who has a why to live can bear almost any how. And that's kind of what really sums up values for me. It's the why. Why are we doing this? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why do you want to do what you're doing? And there's a value there. Now, we all have values. It's one of the things that unites us as human beings. But the reason that people come to coaching is because often you have trouble turning those values into actions. And I kind of see beliefs as a bit of a gateway to that. So one of the reasons that we might struggle to turn our values into actions would be perhaps that we haven't reflected enough on our values, we haven't reflected enough on the why, and we need to just take time to really do that, to really understand it, so that we can actually access the power behind that. Sometimes we're very aware of the power behind that, we're very aware of the why, it's compelling to us, it inspires us, but there's a belief that gets in the way. So something like, that's just not possible, or I can't do that, or I'm just one person, what difference can I make? Those kinds of things that stop us from converting it into an action. And so I think the process of sitting with a coach, but also as a coach, sitting with yourself or sitting with somebody else, and really regularly thinking about our values is incredibly important, and something that we don't really teach people to do. And that's one of the reasons why I think that coaching space is so special, really, particularly in an environment where religion is, you know, less and less prominent. You don't kind of have that space to think about values in that way. But I also think it's important to question our beliefs for the reasons that I just stated. So to kind of test them out, almost like a scientist would test a hypothesis. Is this valid? Is this true? Because values alone don't really do anything beyond the internal unless you've got the belief to back it up. To turn it into an action, then nothing's likely to change. This is the push me pull you from Dr. Doolittle. Does anybody know that?
Yeah.
I used to love it as a child. My brother was absolutely terrified of it, which I think might have been one of the reasons why I loved it so much. This is kind of how I think about motivation. It's a push and a pull. So somebody might be really certain that they want to do a particular thing, but they're aware at the same time that in doing that, they're going to have to give something up. They're going to have to lose something. Something's going to have to change. And they might be unwilling to make that sacrifice or just sort of sit in the middle, not making a choice either way. And this is why I think values are really important. Not just in discovering what those are, what those kind of opposing forces are, but in terms of understanding what it is that people are scared to lose when they're struggling to find motivation. So, for example, if somebody is wanting to lose weight and they're talking about that in terms of diet and they know that they're going to have to give up certain things, certain practical things in terms of their diet, they are likely to think of that in a very umwelt way, a very practical way, calories, food, body, very physical. But there's a value aspect to that as well, of course. There always is. So what is that food doing for me? What does it mean to me? So it could be, for example, that food is used as a reward, that somebody has a stressful life. And it's a kind of a reward process of coming home, being able to indulge, nurture yourself somehow, even if it doesn't end up being that nurturing. And the idea of just taking that away, trying to extract that, and expecting it to work on its own is quite bizarre, really, when you think about it. It's quite absurd, because that plays such an important role. And pretty much anything that you're going to give up for the purpose of a goal is playing some sort of role, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. So there is a value there. There's an important value there that's being met. So there is something about tuning into and questioning what the values are behind something before you kind of get someone into making that change. Do they really understand what the impact of that will be? Have they thought about what life will be like without that present? Because otherwise you end up in this sort of situation where they make a change and a couple of weeks later, it's like they've had the rug pulled out from under their feet. This notion that I talked about briefly earlier of existential coaching being more about being rather than doing is kind of how I think about stuckness. So we get stuck because we think about things in a very doing level. We tend to be quite capable of doing that. I had a teacher once, Yannick might remember actually, who told us an anecdote about how her life as a corporate coach and how she used to get people, you know, high-powered business people, calling her up and saying, right, here is the thing that I want to change, and this is why I want to do it, and this is how I'm going to do it. And they would list every step of the way. And she'd say, well, what do you need me for then? And it's because it's not about doing, it's about being. It's a being problem, not a doing problem. And so this is something that I started to think about in terms of trying to get more to a kind of being perspective. So thinking about feeling rather than doing as an end point in terms of determining a goal. So, for example, I might think, how do I want to feel at the end of the day rather than what do I want to have accomplished by the end of the day? And then work backwards from there. What do I need to do in order to create that feeling? And the effect that has is it kind of opens up your internal dialogue a little bit more. We kind of tend to go around with this idea, you know, well, if you're anything like me, you go around with about 10 different to-do lists all the time. and you're very aware of what needs to be done. But often it's not particularly satisfying. You might finish doing something and feel a little bit at odds or just a bit kind of swept away by the whole thing, not really thought about how you wanted to feel, how you wanted to be with yourself after that. It's all been a sort of crusade to achieve. So, for example, you know, me coming here and giving this speech, I could think about okay, well, I'm going to go through the slide presentation, I'm going to give the speech, you know, and then I'm going to go home. But how do I want to feel about it? And that's really the important question, because I'm going to give the speech regardless. But what's the flavour that I want from it? Do I want to feel like it's about preaching at people? Do I want to feel like it's about knowledge? Do I want to feel like it's about connection? You know, there are so many different options there that we don't tend to evaluate before we jump in. So getting people to go beyond that sort of doing perspective, which is a very sort of coachy perspective, typically, and into this idea of what do I want it to actually be like? What do I want to feel like? And work backwards from there can be quite a powerful thing to do. I spoke a little bit about this, I think, earlier, and I felt it very much actually on the underground. I moved outside of London about 3 years ago, and I've completely forgotten what it's like to be on the London Underground. So that was a bit of a shock to the system. But really, the herd mentality is the idea that we all kind of go along with the crowd. We tend to fall in with the crowd, go along with the herd, don't necessarily think in a very individualistic way, get taken in by things, don't question them too much. And existentialists are very keen on saying, well, hang on a minute, whose ideas are those? Who decided that? So that is very much about listening out for red flags, like should, shouldn't, expectation. Where are those coming from? Who says should? Who says you shouldn't? Who expects this of you? Is it you? Is it somebody else? And trying to get people to think about what they actually believe about it. I've been doing some work with a teenage boy doing his A-levels and thinking about university, and that has been so much in the realm of the herd mentality, because, of course, we go through that process as adolescents, really, trying to figure out, you know, what is our own and what is other people's, and, you know, that's when most people go through a rebellious phase for that exact reason. But, you know, almost every sentence out of his mouth is a, oh, well, I shouldn't be doing that, or I know I should be doing such and such. And it's so difficult sometimes to sort of confront people with that and say, well, but who says? Or why is that important? Why does she know better than you know? Or, you know? There's old Kierkegaard, looking cheery, as existentialists do. Kierkegaard spoke about something called the leap of faith, which is something that we use in everyday language, although not quite in the way that he spoke about it. Now, his idea of this was very much coloured by religion. He was very, very Christian. And he spoke about people that he deemed knights of faith. And pretty much the only people that he thought were true knights of faith were basically religious figures. Mary, Jesus and Abraham, I think, were the only three that he really considered to be proper knights of faith. And what he meant by that was people who are capable of taking actions that are completely aside from reason or rationalization. Because he believed that it was only in doing that, in shunning sort of the rational, that we could truly express freedom, that we could truly be free. Now, I'm not sure how much I agree with that. It's all up for grabs. That's one of the beautiful things about existentialism. It's very much make it your own. What do you think? But I do think it's important in terms of working with people as a coach, because this is something that people tend to struggle with, taking that leap of faith, taking the next step, throwing themselves into something, even though it might not be rationally the obvious thing to do. Pretty much anything that requires change is going to be unlikely to be the most rational thing to do anyway, in terms of risk avoidance and things like that. But of course, most people won't come from a sort of Kierkegaardian faith perspective. They'll come from a more values perspective, because the majority of people who you're going to be working with are not going to be coming from that purely religious paradigm. So that's another way in which I think just tuning into those values, allowing other people to tune into their values and really think about them, can help to make that leap. This is my dog, Callie. Anybody who has a dog or a child... Wait, who has a dog? Who has a child? Who has a dog and a child? Well, you will know better than anyone that if you don't exercise your dog or you don't stimulate your child, then that energy gets completely out of control and becomes destructive. And that is basically how I think about emotion. So I see emotion as energy. It propels us forward into things. It motivates us to do things. It pretty much determines probably the vast majority of our actions to some degree. And the same thing applies. If you don't channel the energy, i.e. if you don't channel the emotion, it turns inward and becomes destructive. And so I think this is really, really important in working in a coaching paradigm, because often strong emotion can become taboo within that paradigm. People kind of feel that that's more of a therapeutic kind of notion, a therapeutic way of working, which is a great shame, because there's so much power in there and it's so important. And this emotional compass, which is Emmy van Deurzen's emotional compass, is basically a model of how emotions relate to values. So on this side, going down, it's about the emotions that tend to come when you're experiencing a loss or threat of some value that's important to you. And this side going up is about the gain for the value. And again, this isn't a roadmap. It's not a, you must do this, 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 this. It's a sort of an explorative tool, really, to think about yours or your client's emotional life and what that means and what kind of patterns there are in there, and how that might make you engage with it differently. So one of the things that I like to encourage people to do is to sit with this for a while and to think about where on there you tend to find yourself. What are the common emotions that you tend to situate yourself in? So at the top, you've got exhilaration and happiness. Obviously, that's when you feel completely at one with the value. You've done it. You're there. Great. That's where everybody thinks that they're trying to get to. Then you start to go on to pride, confidence, arrogance, when perhaps you're holding on a little bit too tightly. Jealousy, worry, vigilance, as you start to see a threat to the value, as you start to perceive that something might happen to kind of take that moment away from you. Anger, hate, and despair, as that starts to happen. Fear, confusion, and cowardice, as you start to kind of withdraw from it. Sorrow, misery, resignation, as you start to realise, I'm resigned to this, it's gone, missed it. Despondency and depression at the bottom, the polar opposite of the exhilaration and happiness. And then there's a sort of a climb here, so you get up onto sort of envy and curiosity and aspiration as you start to reconnect with values and think about how you might engage with them again in your life. And back up on the path there, things like joy, thrill, excitement, thinking about what might be. It's very interesting. Sometimes people find that there are particular bits of this paradigm that they just never seem to find themselves in at all. Like, people will say something like, I'm just not a very angry person. I just don't really get angry. I tend to just get upset and cry. So it's interesting to think about how those patterns come about, what's going on there, and what are the values that are at stake? What is it that triggers them? So when they're in a particularly emotional situation, or, you know, some sort of emotion is coming to the fore, that's an indication that there is a strong value somewhere that's either feeling threatened or that they're striving towards. So it's a flag, basically. It's saying, here we are, here's something that's really important to me. And that's your cue, really, to take a look and drill down. What is that there? What are you scared of losing? What is it that you're really striving towards there? I love that. So the take home from that piece about values, really, is obviously not about stopping being mediocre. It is really just about connecting to what is important to you and thinking about how that impacts absolutely everything that you do, instead of kind of falling into this autopilot mode. And that is kind of really why I wanted to talk about imagery, because I find that imagery is one of the best ways to do that. So the quotation, for those of you who can't see it, Artistic symbols and myths speak out of the primordial, preconscious realm of the mind, which is powerful and chaotic. Both symbol and myth are ways of bringing order and form into this chaos, and that's by Rollo May, who wrote some brilliant things on creativity. The reason that I'm so interested in imagery, really, is that people will tend to verbally just retell the same story over and over again. We kind of rehearse these verbal stories about our lives, about what's going on. And as soon as people start to work in the realm of images, they kind of open up a possibility to look at it in a slightly different way, to not stick to that well-trodden path. So I see them kind of as a solution to stuckness. And it's something that I often tell students to look out for, people throwing imagery in, because we tend to bandy it around. We actually use imagery a lot without necessarily realizing that that's what we're doing. So we'll talk in metaphor, or, you know, we'll throw something into a conversation and not really question it. And what I like to do with clients and with students is to get them to seize that opportunity, because that's an opportunity to go beyond the kind of scripted nature of what people are saying. So jump on that image, get them to go into that image rather than going beyond it, and just stay in that for a bit and use it to describe what's going on in a different way that is not so safe, that is a bit more uncertain. And often you'll find some really, really interesting things within that. This is kind of a cross between imagery and narrative, but it's a great little existential concept, the eternal recurrence, which is basically a challenge to people to think about what would happen if you had to live your life exactly the way that you're living it, over and over and over again, for all eternity. And I hear some uncomfortable laughter. Would anyone like to share what they were thinking?
Oh my God.
Did you just say you wouldn't mind?
Yeah.
Great, good for you. I would. Most people, I think, have the opposite response to you, as we heard by the awkward laughter in the room. Because we kind of just do this autopilot thing. We kind of just battle through as best we can and don't really think about it too much. And I think being aware of your choices to that degree, to the point where you're kind of thinking about that visceral experience of having to live this over and over again, can be quite confronting and potentially really change the way that you're engaging with your own life. Now, it's not necessarily something that you would just whip out and do with a coaching client, but it's something to bear in mind as you're having conversations with them. You know, how do they actually feel about the quality of their life? What is that experience? Is it torturous? Is it uncomfortable? What's going on? Is there any pleasure taken in it? What are we working with? Phenomenology and image. Does anybody know what phenomenology is? Yannick, I'm just going to assume that you know everything, because I know that you know everything. You do. Fab.
Looking at something as the sort of sensory experience. So rather than saying that is a chair, there's a purpleness, but there is a sort of solidity, what is the quality of it rather than what's the label?
That's right, yeah. What's the phenomenon that's going on rather than the sort of all of those bits around it that are assumptions, basically, that we make. So within phenomenology, we talk about bracketing our assumptions, and something called horizontalization, which means that you don't take any one thing that somebody says as more important than another thing. Everything has equal importance. We don't assume any kind of hierarchy. And basically, this is a way of working. I won't go into it too much because Zoe's just given me the signal that I've already got to 45 minutes. Essentially, it's a very good way to work with imagery because you're not actually seeing the image in front of you. You kind of have to do this kind of questioning. You kind of have to have this sort of curious, open response to it where you make no assumptions, so you can really drill down and ask very specific questions about the image that somebody is painting. This is an example of some image work that I did with someone. I will explain. I won't just leave that there for you to figure out. I was working with another case study that I wrote up recently, actually. A man who found that he was... everything in his life was pretty okay. His job was okay. Some marital problems, but nothing really serious. But basically, his problem was that he would wake up on the weekend and just feel really uncomfortable and really tense and couldn't enjoy anything, basically. And so we worked together to think about what this was. But perhaps more importantly, about how he actually wanted to feel, what his expectation was. And we kind of got to this. So he observed that he had just gotten this new kitten, and he'd been watching, well, he'd been stressing out on his computer, working and, you know, doing bits and pieces and feeling very tense. And then the kitten had come and lay on his lap and fell asleep and started purring, and it was just very sort of cozy and calm and soft and gentle. And he said, "I want to be like that. I want to feel like that. I want to feel like that cat does when it's purring." But he also said that he wanted to feel like warm bread, fluffy inside, fluffy and warm. And so we came up with this idea that he wanted to be a purring loaf of bread. And it sounds bizarre, it sounds absurd, and it is absurd, but it's actually quite understandable when you look at it. And in drilling that down, that was actually really, really helpful for him to keep in mind in moments when he was stressing out. Just think, "Oh, I want to be the purring bread." And it just kind of, oddly, for such an absurd thing, grounded him and made him sort of snap out of it. Again, this was another image work example of somebody that I worked with over a very long period of time, who said that she kept getting this image coming to her mind of a horse behind her, looming over her. Which to me, initially, this was an assumption that I had to bracket, working phenomenologically, sounded really imposing and kind of ominous and scary. But actually, as she described it and clarified, it wasn't that. It was that she wanted to be like the horse, that there was something wild and free about the horse, and she didn't feel like that. And then over a long period of time, we developed this thing where there was one horse running wild in a field and one horse that was tied up to a paddock, and she felt somehow like the horse in the paddock who wanted to get out in the field like the other horse. And it was basically an existential tension between freedom and responsibility. So she was feeling overly responsible. She was feeling trapped. It was very much about her home life. And she wanted to feel to be this sort of free, wild, stallion kind of creature. Alter egos and imaginary friends is another way of working with images. This is a drag queen. I love drag queens. I'm obsessed with RuPaul's Drag Race. This is a contestant from RuPaul's Drag Race called Ben de la Creme, real name Benjamin Putnam. And he basically credits his drag character with saving his life because he was depressed, suicidal, and he created this drag character called Ben de la Creme, who he describes as terminally delightful. And through going into that persona and sort of learning to live as that other person, that other kind of side of himself, he started to develop this alter ego that ultimately he credits with saving his life, because it showed him a completely different way of being. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all come out of here and dress in drag, although I'd be up for that if anybody wants to. but there's... But there's something very powerful about that process of sort of thinking about other sides of yourself that perhaps aren't so easy to express or aren't so easy to connect with, not necessarily to sort of go and act them out in this very exaggerated persona, but to think about how those might inspire you. And the same with imaginary friends. There's a wonderful book by somebody called Dina Glauberman, who's a psychotherapist. She's not existential, but the way that she works is quite phenomenological. And she talks about using imagery with people to come up with imaginary friends who sort of help them out in situations that they're uncomfortable with. So she talks about a client that she worked with who really, really hated clothes shopping and just couldn't do it, felt really panicky when she was doing it. So they created together this imaginary friend who was like an Egyptian goddess who was really fabulous and sophisticated and would just sort of help her pick things out and taught her to enjoy it more, taught her to connect to this other way of doing it. Metaphor and similes, I kind of talked about, same principle really. When someone brings up a metaphor, don't just leave it alone. Dig in there and see. Because a lot of the time we assume that we're using a metaphor in the same way, that we have the same understanding of it. I don't know if anybody else has had the experience of thinking that you're having a really profound realization or insight about something and then realizing that actually it's a really common phrase that people use and you just never really fully understood it. That might be just me, but I do that a lot. But it's the same principle, you know, we kind of use these things, we haven't necessarily thought about them. So pick up on them, go off the beaten track, explore them, play with them. The one word of warning I would say when working with imagery is, well, it's an existential principle anyway, which is just about working with what the client gives you and not putting anything of your own into there as an assumption. A class that I was teaching recently, we had a practice session and somebody was talking about all of the different bits of their life that they felt out of control of, trying to tend them all. And the practitioner said something along the lines of, oh, when you say that, it sounds to me as if you're talking about a garden and it's like all of the plants in the garden that you have to tend and, you know, take the weeds out, which is a lovely metaphor, but it didn't come from the person. And it turned out that that person actually had quite a bad fear of plants. So it was the worst possible metaphor that she could have used and completely, basically made the session come to a standstill. Body work. Listening to the body, getting people to tune into the body, what kind of knowledge is there? I have gotten into the habit recently of doing a sort of a body scan every night as I lay in bed to try and figure out what the tacit knowledge is there. Where are the tensions? What kind of sensations are going on? How do we make sense of that? It's particularly useful for people who are more physical, who live more in that Umwelt mode, because they won't necessarily think of things in a sort of a verbal way or in a values-based way, or, you know, you can get them to access those different kinds of experiences, those different kind of perhaps more emotional pieces of their life by getting them to go into their body and relating to it in that way. I'm rushing through slightly because I'm aware of time. Image work for the coach. Create your own images. This is what I like to do. These are my terrible, terrible images. I never pretended to be an artist. But this was a sort of a theory that I had, well, not a theory, a formulation that I had about relating to others and how we relate to others. So this is the kind of core self. This is a little bit of a buffer that we have around the self. And then these are other people and how we relate to other people. So some people do this sort of domineering thing where they're spiky and they kind of go into other people's zones. Some people have this, well, this would be a neutral one with nothing there. This is one that I notice a lot of female clients seem to relate to, which is this kind of absorbent personality where you kind of take on other people's spikiness, other people's intrusion, and kind of just sit with it in a sort of uncomfortable way. Racing through, taking it forward, just be about creativity, being creative in the way that you work, using every crayon in the box. And finally, narrative. So a myth is a way of making sense in a senseless world. Myths are narrative patterns that give significance to our existence. That's Ryan May again. Without narrative, I don't think we're ever really without narrative. And the reason that I chose this picture is because I was watching a wonderful film called Life in a Day. Has anyone seen that? Oh, it's brilliant. It's basically they asked people across the world to submit, I can't remember, was it 1 minute or 3 minute clips, all on the, from their lives, from the exact same day. It was a particular date, I can't remember, 26th of July, some year. And then they just edited it into a feature-length film from morning to night, all across the world, different countries. Fascinating, I would really recommend it. But as the credits roll, this snail starts moving across the screen, and it doesn't really have any kind of narrative meaning. But in the cinema, everybody was kind of turning to each other and trying to, you know, theorise about what the snail meant. And it made me think about how we can't help trying to attach meaning to everything. We just do it all the time. So I don't think we're ever without some kind of narrative. I think by default we create narratives for ourselves. And really my perspective on that is not in a sort of a narrative coaching way, not, you know, in the same way that you would do in narrative research, for example, about actively getting people to create stories, but just attending to what stories people are bringing you. We're always bringing a story. And if you can tune into that and really think about what is the narrative that that person is telling you, it can give you a lot of clues about where they're stuck, what's going on for them, where they might perhaps be a bit more flexible, a bit more creative, what their experience is like. And being a companion in that rather than an observer, so going along with them in the narrative, walk with them down that road, be with them in there, feel what it's like to be them, explore it, be curious, be open. Because ultimately, if people don't feel that you have done that, they're unlikely to listen to pretty much anything that you have to say. I also think it's important to think about what your narrative is as a coach and how does that influence how you practice. What do you feel your role is? What's going on? What's your narrative in relation to this particular client? How do you feel when you're with them? What do you feel like the quality of your relationship is? What's going on in that relationship? What's the story there? Dream work as well. This is a big topic. We've not much time, but we do have time for questions, so that's good. What I wanted to say really essentially about narrative work in dream is not to get too hung up on things like symbolism, but to think about the overall story in a dream, particularly the emotional journey in a dream, because that is actually quite a profound way of doing dream analysis. Instead of thinking about what, you know, the tree meant in that situation, it's how did you feel in the dream? What was the emotional journey of the dream? And when you get people to distill that, drill it down and sort of simplify it and come up with a proper formulation about what that experience was, and then you ask them, does that feel like anything else in your life? Usually the light bulb goes on and it becomes completely clear what the dream meant. Narratives in the coaching room, little sort of microcosms for what's going on in the person's life. I remember one of the things on our training that we used to always come back to was the session always begins long before you think it's begun. I remember doing a practice session with somebody once when I asked for volunteers to do this practice session in front of the class, and one person put his hand straight up and said, I'll do it. I said, which role do you want to be, coach or client? He said, either, I'll do it, whatever you need. And then of course, the entire topic of the conversation when he was then the client in front of the class was about responsibility and how he always takes responsibility for things. What had he just done? Taken responsibility for the entire class. So those little signals, all those little tiny narratives that make up everything we do are significant, and they tell you about somebody's experience of being in the world. Art and media, that I just wanted to talk briefly, very briefly now, about using people's love of art and media to tune into their narratives and their values within those narratives. So, you know, if somebody really loves Les Miserables, for example, somebody might mean me. Is that because they really love the sort of epic love story side of it? Is it something about the revolutionaries? Is it what is going on there? What's the sort of narrative thread that is so meaningful to them? Gosh, I've got no time for good old Sartre's Bad Faith, which is basically about our constant denial of our own freedom. So we will avoid making choices because we feel, well, or we'll say that we're making a choice because we don't, in fact, have a choice. What we mean by that is that we have an assumption about what we should or shouldn't do, or what we can or can't do. And actually, we have the freedom to choose pretty much anything within certain boundaries. So really the point with this was going to be just to be aware of people denying their freedom, making assumptions about what they can or can't do, what they should or shouldn't do, and challenging that. Why can't you? Is it because you've actually made a judgment that this isn't the way that you want to do it? Or, you know, is there something, a value at stake here that's too precious to lose? But owning the choices that we make, or owning that we're choosing not to choose, which is still a choice. A brief thing about working with existential tensions. So this is about noticing where people are within certain existential tensions. So, gosh, this one hasn't come out very well, unfortunately. But the balance between absurdity and meaning, where we find ourselves in those, are we somebody who sort of jokes around a lot and lives in the world of the absurd and finds it difficult to sort of pin themselves down and make meaning in something, or are we sort of really heavily meaning focused and need to lighten up sometimes? Authenticity and inauthenticity. I remember being very, very relieved when I realised that the existential perspective was that it's okay to be inauthentic, and we will be inauthentic lots of times, again and again, and it's fine. But where do you find yourself in that? Do you feel like you have to sort of constantly be this really, you know, authentic person? Or do you feel like you're sort of faking your way through things? And responsibility and freedom, sort of like the horse imagery that I was talking about, where do we find ourselves in that? Do we tend to take on too much responsibility or see ourselves like that? Or do we tend to go, I'm free, I can do anything and not take any responsibility? So tuning into where people see themselves on that and just kind of questioning it, prodding it, maybe having a little bit of a rebalance. I don't really have time for that. That's the whole thing. There's Morgan Freeman. You can't talk about narration without Morgan Freeman. Really, what I wanted to say was just think about narratives. Think about the narrative that's going on for you right now. What is the story that you're telling yourself? What is the story that you're telling people in your lives? And what does that mean? And how does that limit you? Life has no meaning a priori. It is up to you to give it a meaning. And value is nothing but the meaning that you choose. And that pretty much sums up the existential perspective in a nutshell. It's about uncovering truth. The challenges that we have in coaching are the challenges that we have, that we all have personally. They're one and the same. Self-deception, stuckness, glossing over our values, not tuning into them, wanting to be a fixed object, something that is, you know, that we achieve a goal and we've arrived and that's that and no more trouble. And that this repetition of our narrative without question. So the solutions to that, I think, are about creating lasting, meaningful change, not just addressing a doing thing, but a being thing, empowering people to become philosophers in their own lives, getting them to think about, basically it's psychoeducation, getting people to think about themselves philosophically so that they can go away and take it into their lives and not feel that they have to come back to a coach every time to do it. I like making money, but I prefer being ethical. Owning up to responsibilities and freedom, getting to know yourself better. And for me, it's about a kinder, gentler way of being that doesn't shirk the challenges of life. And this is the call to action, really. Man is nothing else but what he makes of himself, such as the first principle of existentialism. And that's good old Sartre, who I gave pretty much no time to. And that's it.